And we're in the Sermon on the Mount. And what we have done is we've looked through what? Sermon on the Mount. And we've looked at the Beatitudes and those wonderful foundational, somebody called them the beautiful attitudes. And if we live here, okay, we will have an impact here in the world as being the salt of the earth and the light of the world. And as we were saying last week, that human life cannot exist without salt and light. And so if we live here, we will have impact here into the world. And now we're moving on and to the main body of the sermon, and we're going to do two things. We will look at the continuity with the old, which we really touched on last week. And so our focus this morning is going to be the surpassing of the old, where Jesus says six times, you've heard it said, you've heard it said, don't commit murder, I say, don't be angry. You've heard it said, don't commit adultery, I say, don't even look on a woman to lust after her. And so this is where we're going to be this morning, and then we'll be moving on through the sermon in the coming weeks. So we're going to read, and if you take your Bible, we're actually going to read each verse as we come to it. But if you open to Matthew chapter 5, and I want to show you these six contrasts or antitheses that Jesus works through. So I won't read all the verses because we'll read them all as we come to them, but I want you to see it in your text. And so Matthew 5, we've gone through the Beatitudes, and in verse 17, very important, we looked at this last week, Jesus says, do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. And so he has got to make clear his commitment to Torah, okay? Torah is not disappearing, okay? It is being filled full and going to what God had as its highest kind of ethical dimension. And we were looking at that last week and delving into some of the Old Testament verses. So he's established, he hasn't come to abolish, but to fill full the Torah. So verse 21, I just want to go through these six. You have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder. Verse 22, but I say unto you, and that I say unto you is emphatic in Greek, but I say unto you that everybody who's angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. Verse 27, the second contrast, you've heard it said, you shall not commit adultery, but I say unto you that everybody who looks on a woman to lust after her has committed adultery in his heart. And so here we have, and I'll say this in a minute, it's like we have a new Moses on a new mountain, the upper mountain, and what's happening is not the negation of the law, but it's being filled full by Jesus. Verse 31, the third one, and it was said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give a certificate of dismissal. But I say unto you, and we'll read that verse later on. The fourth one, verse 33, again, you have heard it said by the ancients, you shall not make false vows. Verse 34, but I say unto you, make no oath at all. Verse 38, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. This is number 5. But I say unto you, do not resist him who is evil. And then the last one, verse 43, you have heard it said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. So just to work our way in here very quickly, all I want to say is 3 things. Jesus is bringing the law to its fulfillment, and this is a new Sinai here. And if I would just put up a little chart so that you could see the contrast, and you know that in Matthew, Jesus is being presented as the new Moses. And we've probably worked through about 10 parallels between Moses and Jesus so far. There are at least another 20 to come in the book. But here we have a great contrast. Okay, there was a mountain that they went to after they came out of Egypt, and now they're on a mountain in Galilee. There was one man on that mountain, only Moses. But now everybody can come up into the presence of God. Men, women, and children are all present. You go to Exodus 19, and it's speaking of the mountain, and it says there was fire, darkness, smoke, earthquake. And God had to establish his authority, his power over the gods of Egypt, over the gods of Babylon. So there needs to be a demonstration of the power of God. But now we have peace, sunshine, tranquility, community. It's being, you see, filled full. Doesn't negate this, but now we have another manifestation of the presence of God. On the mountain, we had transcendence, but now we've got what we call immanence or intimacy or Emmanuel, God with us. On the mountain of Sinai, we had external commands written on stone. Now we've got internal attitudes that will be imprinted on us by the Holy Spirit, beginning with the Beatitudes, the beautiful attitudes. On the mountain, God had to take the nation of Israel that was polluted by the surrounding cultures from vengeance to justice. We'll see more of that. An eye for an eye is justice. It's moving away from vengeance. And I'll say this later on, but if you travel around the cultures of the world, you'll still see this legacy of vengeance. There is a Pashtun proverb in Afghanistan, and it says, he is no Pashtun who does not return a pinch with a punch. You see, a vengeance culture is not justice. It's retaliation. You break my arm and my brother comes and kills you. And I don't know, I was just thinking yesterday of the film Beyond the Gates of Splendor. How many of you have seen that film, Beyond the Gates of Splendor? No, it is about, somebody said, was it about China? It's based on the book by Elizabeth Elliot, and you've got to see this film, okay? I believe it's available in the video shops, Beyond the Gates of Splendor. You've got to see it. Pastor Murdoch, it's a beautiful film, is it not? It really is. There aren't many, but this is a good one. This is a good one. And there, these 5 young men, they're martyred as they take the gospel to the Alca Indians in Ecuador. 5 wonderful young men. And I can remember when I became a Christian, they were martyred in the mid-50s. I became a Christian in the mid-60s, and this was still news. It was just like something that touched the whole country, Christian and non-Christian. But in the Oka tribe, there was not one family who had not had a member speared, because that's a vengeance culture. Now, Jesus brings them to justice, and that's an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. We'll look at that. But now we're moving beyond justice, because once you understand justice, then you can understand mercy. And so we're moving from an eye to an eye to turning the other cheek. And finally, we're moving from law, not to the cancellation of law, but law being radicalized, taken higher into love. And we'll come to that. And so we have a new Moses on a new mountain. And on the basis of this, now we can have all these. Only on the basis of what had happened before, we can now have a transcendence of that into a higher realm. And the last thing I want to say by way of introduction is the six areas, these six contrasts, are not random. They're not random. Now, what's happening here, and I'll put up a diagram, and they are basic to who we are as the kingdom people, the new humanity. They're basic, and there's some integrity about them. Now, in the early church, they said that if you could get a hold on money, sex, and power, if you could bring those things in your life under control, you would be free to love. It wasn't simply that you would be sexually pure, and you would not be seduced by materialism. That's right. We want to bring those under control. But it was so that you would be free to love, free to love. And you'll remember that the three basic vows came out of this, and it wasn't just for the monastics, it was for all Christians, and they dealt with money by a vow of poverty. And Jesus calls us to simplicity of lifestyle, whether we're a monastic or not. Then they dealt, secondly, with the area of sex by a vow of purity or chastity, which did not necessarily mean celibacy, but it meant I will bring my sexual life under control. And then thirdly, they dealt with power by a vow of obedience, saying I will make no major decision without an authority structure covering me. And they felt if they could bring those three, money, sex, and power, under control, it would release them to love. That was the whole point. Not just personal holiness, but being released to love. Now, what we'll find as we go through, that these six areas, and we can go to oaths and anger, that's connected into money. We'll go to divorce, adultery, connected into sex. We'll go to an eye for an eye, love for enemies, connected into power. And so these are not random. These are not random. Get a hold of these, and you will be free to love. And that's the point. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and your neighbor as yourself. On this, you remember Jesus said, hang what? On this hang what? All the law and the prophets. That's right. And so if you can get hold of this, you see, by the Spirit, you're fulfilling the law. They all hang. I remember we always had a washing line. Now, washing lines have not become so popular because now we have dryers. And in some communities, they have a community covenant where you can't have a washing line, which I think is awful. I love to see washing lines. And doesn't it smell good when it's been dried in the sun? Just smells great. Anyway, on this line, okay, of loving God and loving your neighbor, everything else hangs. Everything else hangs. And this is freeing us to love. And I remember I used to swing on the washing line when I was a kid. Used to break it, and then I was in trouble. But anyways, we won't go there. So we'll avoid the sins of my youth. So let's go on to verse 21, where we are, first of all, dealing with murder. And Jesus says, "You've heard it said, the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder, and whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. But I say unto you that everybody who's filled with rage against his brother or sister shall be guilty of the court, and whoever says to his sister or brother," now how do you pronounce this, Eugene? Reka. Okay, Reka. Am I doing okay, Betty? Reka. That'll do. Okay. Want to get it right. "Shall be guilty to the Sanhedrin. And whoever says fool shall be liable to the fiery Gehenna." Hell, in fact. Now, anger, as we know, because we're told in 1 John, okay, anger, wrath and rage is murdering your brother in your hearts. That's what it is. That's what the root of murder is. It begins with anger. And Jesus says, and there's kind of a little progression here. He says, now, if you're angry, you deserve, if you're angry with your brother, if there's rage, you deserve, okay, to come before the local Sanhedrin. They had Sanhedrins in all the big cities. And then, if you say Reka, you are liable for the, and I should say, the local Sanhedrins, they dealt with cases of murder. And it's interesting, Jesus says, if you're angry, you go before the local Sanhedrin. Why? Because it's murdering your brother in your hearts. Okay, if you say Reka, then you are guilty to go before the great Sanhedrin. Okay, this is what you deserve. It's not necessarily what you'll get. This is what you'll deserve, the highest court in the land. And then if you say fool, you're guilty of the fire of Gehenna, the final place of judgments. Now, this word Reka is an insult. And it was very serious in that culture, very serious, because of the dignity attached to names. Now, we don't think of this very much, but you capture the dignity of the person in their name. And so, for instance, Elisha, his name means God is salvation. And God has crowned him. Your name is your crown. Your name is your crown in biblical thinking. And if I rename you, I'm diminishing the image of God in you. That's what I'm doing. Now, I rarely say bad language, but I will say this, and you'll hear it all the time at work. They'll say, "He is a real bastard." Okay? Now, you can hear in that, It's a silly thing because it's saying he's illegitimate. Well, if he is illegitimate, which he probably isn't, it's nothing to do with him. But you can hear in the very word a kind of diminishment of the person. You can hear it in the word, can't you? There's just a lowering, and if you do that to the image of God, Jesus says you deserve to be hauled before the high courts. You deserve to go before the Supreme Court because you are minimizing the image of God, which must be protected. You see, where we go on the next line, you see, to insult somebody is to insult the God in whose image they're made. And if we guard the image of God at this verbal level, we'll also guard it at the more serious levels: abortion, euthanasia, genetic engineering, eugenics, etc. And what's happening, and you'll always find it, is where names are honored, where people are giving dignity, human life is valuable. When you start to denigrate people on the verbal level, you'll also do it on every other level, because you're really saying the image of God either doesn't exist or isn't important, so we can abort children, we can euthanize the elderly, and we can do genetic engineering. And so what we do on this level is very important, and Jesus picks it up. And thirdly, to say the word fool, which of course is a deranged person, this would not be how we would use it in the English language. Now, I was saying the other day that for a Jew, certain things were just like the first few notes of a song. And you guys gave me Coldplay, okay? You see, I would say the Beatles, but you've never heard of the Beatles, you see. They were in the 16th century, you know. But Coldplay, okay. Now, if you're really a Coldplay fan, just the first few notes of a song, and you know what it is, okay? For a Jew, there would be connections that would come immediately. And when you heard the word fool, you would immediately think of Psalm 14, which says the fool has said in his heart, what? There is no God. And if you deny God, you go to hell. But Jesus reverses it and say, if you're saying go to hell, and that's what you really mean, you really mean it, and that's where a fool goes, he said, that's exactly where you are going. Okay, if that's what you're saying, if that's what's in your heart, that's what's really in your heart, it's not just language, this is what you wish on somebody, then the problem is with you. And Gehenna, interestingly, was the Valley of Hinnom, where in the Old Testament they sacrificed children, a defiled place. And in Jesus' day, the city's refuge was burnt there. And so if we despise the image of God in man in any way, we're of no value, and we may as well be disposed of on the rubbish heap. Verse 23, therefore, when you find a therefore in the Bible, you should ask, what's it therefore? That's right. And there's a connection, because now these are being applied. And Jesus says, if you're presenting an offering at the altar to ask for God's forgiveness, and there you remember that your brother, okay, who you've been perhaps calling a fool or raker, or you've been angry with him, has something against you because you've sinned against him, leave your offering. Okay, so you have to find somebody and say, would you just look after my offering for a few hours? And you need to run off. And immediately, Jesus says, immediately, first be reconciled to your brother, then come and present your offering. Now, it's very interesting, and I checked this out with Eugene, that in Israel, you remember you came to the great Day of Atonement. It was the kind of high points of national forgiveness. And it was on the 10th day of the 7th month, the end of the Feast of Tabernacles, the great Day of Atonement. Now, on the first day of the 7th month was a feast called the Blowing of Trumpets. And that's how it began. And now, this is the interesting thing. On day 10, okay, you're going to have Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, where God is going to forgive the nation. But beginning on day 1, you have to go to anybody you've sinned against and ask for forgiveness. And you've got 9 days to do it. And so what's it saying? What's it saying? Before we come before God and ask for his forgiveness, we are going to be a community that's going to be reconciled by asking for forgiveness. And you had 9 days to get that done. And that's why Jesus says, forgive us our sins. Pray this, forgive us our sins as we have, what? As we have forgiven those who sin against us. It's just built. It's just built on Yom Kippur. That's what they did every year. They knew before they came to God to ask for forgiveness, they had to set things right in their own hearts. Now, I just want to, this might seem obvious, but I want to try and define what forgiveness is. Would anybody like to offer a definition of forgiveness? Okay, so Brian sitting over there, okay, has sinned against me, and I need to forgive him. Now, we know the word. What am I doing? Define it. What's forgiveness? Let's go to deeper things. Somebody has been physically abused, or somebody has been raped, or somebody was abused as a child. What is forgiveness? What is it? Canceling a debt. Okay. It's a heart decision. Some more? Okay. We're getting some great definitions here. Let's see if there are any more in the class. Okay. You're taking responsibility. That's right. That's part of it. Taking responsibility for your own attitudes. Okay. It's an act of pardon. But what is pardon? Do you want to... What is pardon? Okay, I'm trying to tease it out here. Now, okay, let me give you one definition that I came across. It's to treat you as though it had never happened. I don't think that is necessarily right. You see, if you have been raped, you can't treat that person as if it has never happened. Okay? If you have been brutally divorced, you can forgive, we should always forgive, but you can't treat that person as if it's never happened, okay? Something in the social fabric has been broken. And so now on minor things, I think you can. And so in some ways, to treat the person as if it had never happened, now I can do that with Brian, okay? Because he's not going to do anything too heavy to me. And I can just, he never has actually, but I can treat him as if it's never happened, okay? But when we get deeper, you can't necessarily do that because some social fabric has been torn. And the definition I like is forgiveness is we offer to forgo our rights for justice. We offer to forgo our rights for justice. And you were all tiptoeing around that with your definitions, which were very good. Yes. vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Okay. So I want to make that clear because some people, how many of you have read The Sunflower Seed? Sunflower Seed. Just two or three. This is a book you have to read, The Sunflower Seed. Because what happens, Simon Wiesenthal who wrote the book, or was it Elie Wiesel? I always mix them up. Anyways, you can Google it, The Sunflower Seed. It is an astonishing book because the first half of the book is an account of a young German, and he has been in the Nazi youth movements, and now he becomes, what was the group that were close, Hitler's kind of... Yes, he became a part of the SS. He was 22, became part of the SS. And they had this instance where there was a kind of a large, almost like a warehouse or mansion, and it was full of Jews. And they were asked to torch it, basically. And anybody who jumped out of the windows, they were to shoot. And this young man, 22 years old, he participated in that. And as the war went on, he got very ill, and he was dying. And he asked if they could find a Jew in a concentration camp so that the Jew would come and he would ask for forgiveness for what he had done. Okay? Now, this is being written by a Jew. Okay? Simon Wiesenthal. Okay? And that's the first half of the book. The second half is he sends out a questionnaire to major leaders like the Dalai Lama and others, not just religious leaders, every name you would know. That's the second half of the book, saying, what would you do? What would you do? Because the Jewish man who came from the concentration camp, he said, I can't forgive you. I can't forgive you. But he sat there and held his hand while he was dying. He sat there and held his hand while he's dying. What's that saying? What's that saying? You see, I don't think he understood what forgiveness was. You don't sit there and hold the hand of a man who's dying. And then the responses from these leaders is astonishing, because what you realize is that they don't understand what forgiveness is. Forgiveness is saying, it's okay. It's okay that you did. It's not okay. It's not okay. You deserve to go to hell. But I'm releasing you from my right to justice. That's what forgiveness is. It's very, very profound. And widely, people say, I can't forgive. Because it's like saying, it's okay. No, no, that's not forgiveness. It's not saying it's okay. It's saying it's not okay. And you deserve retribution, but I'm forgoing my rights for justice. And so that needs to be clear, and it's not clear to many people. And so in the kingdom, reconciliation and right relationships, you remember that I defined righteousness as right relatedness, is indispensable if people are to realize that a new humanity is coming into existence. And I've told some of you this before, but I will never forget something that happened in my house in Cyprus. Because if you ask a Greek, who is your enemy, they will say, the Turk. If you ask the Turk, who is your enemy, they will say, the Greek. And the two do not mix. But in our church in Limassol, in Cyprus, we decided, wouldn't it be great if we had in our church Jews and Palestinians, because many came to Cyprus, if we had Turks and Greeks. In other words, if we could have a room full of people who hate each other, wouldn't that be wonderful? Wouldn't that be wonderful? And we did. We had Greeks and we had Turks. We had Arabs and we had Jews. And we also had the secret police who would come and sit at the back because they didn't understand what in the world was going on in this room and that there was going to be murder in this room. But the instance I remember is when I was interviewing people for baptism in my house. And there was a little circle, and they thought they were all Greeks. And when they came to Nazim, he was a Turk. But they looked the same. But as soon as he started to speak, they realized he was not a Greek. He was the enemy. He was a Turk. And somebody over the other side of the room, when Nazim started to speak, he got up, and I thought, no, there's going to be murder in my front room now, you know. It's going to be horrible. He ran over to the other side. He embraced Nazim, and he said, "You are my brother. You are my brother." He never knew that that could happen. And that's what Jesus is talking about here. This is the kind of community we need to be. So he goes on. And he says in verse 23, "Therefore, make friends quickly with your opponent at law while you're with him on the way, so that your opponent may not hand you over to the judge and the judge to the officer and you be thrown into prison. Truly, I say, you'll not come out of there until you've paid up the last cent." Now, this is not a new Jesus is saying, you've heard it said, but I say unto you. Okay, this is not a new one. We're still under anger right here. And so what it is, it's an application of it. It's an application of it. And your adversary, your opponent, is somebody to whom money is owed. Because it says you'll not come out until you've paid the last cent. And so what Jesus is saying is, now we've talked about anger, talked about right relationship. Now he's saying financial integrity is crucial if we're to guard our testimony before unbelievers. And so make it right away. Make it right away. Now, one of the things that I find the most disturbing, and Pastor Murdoch and Nancy would have had years of this more than me, is about, you get Christianity Today or one of the other journals, and probably I would say about once every 2 years you hear of a massive financial scandal within the church. This is just an example. And participants in the greater ministries programs were victims of a massive Ponzi scheme, a conspiracy based on fraud, greed, and misrepresentation. For more than 5 years, greater ministries operated what was called Double Your Money, Double Your Blessing, or a Faith Promise program, in which participants expected to double their money, their investments with them, in less than 18 months. And they said this was possible because of the ministry's involvement in highly lucrative overseas mining ventures for gold, silver, platinum, and diamonds. And I remember reading of this. They said, we can double your money in 18 months because we have mining interests as this Christian ministry, in gold, silver, platinum, and diamonds. And at one point, they claimed to own an international bank. And Greater Ministries gifting program was promoted in all 50 states, until ultimately it took in hundreds of millions of dollars. And it was all a Ponzi scheme run by Christians. Now, the world laughs at us. The world laughs at us when we do that. Now, it's interesting that we don't judge the Torah by the behavior of the Jews. And so we go, Eugene, to people like Manasseh, you know, who was so wicked, or the kings in the north, all of whom were evil. But we don't judge the Torah because the law, Paul says, is holy, just, and good. We don't just judge the law by the behavior of the Jews, okay? And we shouldn't judge Jesus by the behavior of Christians. But people do. People do. They say there's this kind of thing. Or it might be on a much minor level where a Christian has not had complete financial honesty and integrity before another Christian. And it happens. And I can remember us talking about things like this. The people, I can remember when I was in Dunkirk, my brother pastored a church in Dunkirk. And it was not a very big church, but we came to communion. And he said, "Ray, you'll notice that that man over there will not take communion. And you'll notice that that man over there will not take communion. And you know why? There's a dispute between them." And I can't remember the details, but I think it was financial, okay? There had been some sort of financial mismanagement. And then he said, "And you'll notice that man over there and that man over there will not take communion for the same reason." And I thought, this is really peculiar. This doesn't happen in England. This doesn't happen in America. I mean, we don't sit in the sanctuary whispering to each other saying, "They won't take communion and they won't take communion because they're not reconciled." And I thought, what's happening here? And then I realized, you see, there was no other church for them to go to in Dunkirk. This was the only one. Now, what happens in North America? We just go off to another church. We don't get reconciled. We go now to the First Baptist Church instead of the Presbyterian Church or whatever. We simply, you know, we simply slide out. But it still stands before God. And it still stands before a watching world. And Jesus says it cannot be. It cannot be. And he will not have it. He will not have it among his people. Let's move on. Number two, adultery. Moving round the segment, moving round the circle. And Jesus says, "You've heard it said that you shall not commit adultery. But I say unto you," emphatic, "everybody who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart." Now, adultery can be an act of the imagination and what one would do if the opportunity arose. Let me say, this is not saying you don't admire somebody who is handsome or somebody who is beautiful. Because that's part of God's good creation. We admire flowers. We admire sunsets. Okay? We admire beautiful snowflakes. All part of creation. And we admire people who are Beautiful, beautiful physically. Nothing wrong with that. Admiring somebody who is handsome or beautiful. Now, there was a segment of the Pharisees, and they were actually called the bruised and bleeding Pharisees. And I think some of you know why. Now, no Jewish rabbi could be seen talking to any woman on the street, not even his wife or his sister or his daughter. He couldn't talk to on the street. But certain Pharisees went further, and they would not even look at a woman on the street. So they would close their eyes. Now, of course, they'd have to keep walking because there were all kinds of women on the street. And therefore, they knocked into walls and houses and other concrete objects, and they were bruised and bleeding. But their bruises and their bleeding, they saw as the marks of their piety, that they never looked at a woman. Jesus is not saying that. He's saying what you're doing is an act of the imagination, and what you would do if you had the opportunity to do so. And I said last week, and this is a quote, that purity is reverence for the image of God in the body. I believe that's a beautiful phrase. Purity is reverence for the image of God in the body. And that's why pornography is so demeaning of the image of God, because we commoditize the image of God. But purity sees the glory of God revealed in the body. Without purity, we can't see the other person. And I said a couple of weeks ago that the body has a supernatural capacity, because personhood is a mystery. We don't even know what personhood is. It's a mystery, but it's embodied. And there's something of transparency about the body. I can look at Steve and I can only see his body, but there's a transparency by looking at you. I can only see skin. I can only see eye tissue. But there's a transparency, and through it, I can see something of the beauty of the person in the image of God. But if all I'm doing with my eyes is taking your clothes off, I'll never see personhood. And so purity is important if we're to see the image of God. If I'm really to see you, I've got to be pure. I've got to be pure. If I'm really to see who you are in the image of God, in all that splendor, in all that glory, I've got to have purity of heart. And that's what Jesus is dealing with here. And he goes on, these well-known verses, and he says, if your right eye, now notice it's metaphorical, because if you take your right eye out, you could still lust with your left eye. So it's metaphorical. If your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you. And although it's metaphorical, we can't reduce the radical nature of this statement. For it's better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into the rubbish dump, into hell, into Gehenna. If your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. For it's better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than your whole body to go into Gehenna. Because our lives have become trash, we end up in the rubbish dump. Okay. Now, we must not dilute the radical nature of what Jesus is saying just because it's metaphorical. He's not asking you to cut your hand off, okay? He's not asking you to pluck your eye out. But he is saying it. He is saying it. And I remember I had a friend when I worked with OM and George Voa, and this friend, his name was Torres, and he had a mangled arm right down to his hand. And he said, I am so glad that I have this mangled arm. Because he said, I knew I was called by God. I knew that I should be living a life of discipleship, but I wasn't. I was being corrupted by money. I was beginning to run after other women. And he caught his arm in a piece of farm machinery. I don't know quite what it was. And it mangled his arm all the way down to his hand. And he says, I am so glad that happened because it stopped him in his tracks. It stopped him on his way to hell. And he said, I would prefer this to what would have happened to me. And that's what Jesus is saying here. That's what Jesus is saying here. I'm reminded of a number of things. One is rather amusing, and I don't know, I know John is a historian and perhaps he can help us. I'll mention that the church father Origen, an unusual man, his father was being taken out to be martyred as a Christian when he was 18, and he wanted to go with his dad and lay down his life for Jesus. So his mother hid all his clothes. So he couldn't. He was naked. He couldn't go out the house because she didn't want him to die. But Origen took this so seriously that he castrated himself so that he could be sexually pure. Now, in his later life, he realized he shouldn't have done that. I didn't realize that would produce the response it did in the class. Okay. Later in life, he realized that he didn't have to do that. There was the power of the Spirit, the power of the indwelling life of Jesus to keep him pure. But he did it because he took it very seriously as a young man. And there was a practice in North America, and about the 18th century, well, I know it was around the time of the Revolution, but how many of you have seen the film The Patriot with Mel Gibson? Okay, now there's an incident in that film where they did something, but I don't know what it was called. They had this practice that when a couple was engaged, they could spend time together, sometimes even the night together, but they put the man, well, we call it in England a straitjacket. It was kind of a sack that went from his neck to his ankles, and they sewed him up in this sack, and they said, now you can spend as long as you like alone with my daughter, but you're sewn up in the sack. And I think this is such a great idea, okay? I want to bring it back. Now, it has a name. Does anybody know the name? Sorry? Bundling. Bundling bag. Okay, we need to bring them back, folks, because hormones are out of control in our society. We need to bring back the bundling bag, okay? Great idea. But what were they doing? I mean, we laugh, but they were just taking these words seriously. Better to pluck out your eye, cut off your hand. So we're going to not do that. We're going to put you in a bundling bag, okay? Now you can spend time with my daughter. So I think we should have Trinity bundling bags, okay? So just keep those hormones in check. So thirdly, divorce. It was said, whoever sends his wife away let him give her a certificate of divorce. This was for her protection. Wasn't what God wanted. God said he gave it for the hardness of their hearts when he gave the law. Jesus says, but I say unto you that everybody who divorces his wife except for the reason of marital unfaithfulness, porneia in the Greek, makes her commit adultery. Because, you see, she either has to become a prostitute or she has to go out and remarry. But the point is, she is still married. There's not been any sexual activity with another man. So she's still married. So if he sends her away, he forces her to commit adultery because she's still married in the eyes of God. And whoever marries a divorced woman in those circumstances commits adultery because he's marrying, as it were, a married woman. Now, I'm not going to get into all the complexities of divorce and remarriage at this point. If you have questions, you can ask me. But we do get into, and I think Pastor Nancy would agree, some of the most difficult situations in the church. And if you are divorced and remarried here this morning, peace be to you, because there's forgiveness. There's forgiveness. But this is a difficult one, and it comes in all shapes, sizes, convolutions. And I thought some years ago I had heard every kind of combination that you could possibly imagine trying to untangle the situations people get into, you know, when they get married, married again, marry the first person, marry again, and just, it just gets, you know, so knotted up. Now, I thought I'd heard everything until I was at a conference teaching, and after one of the sessions, somebody came up to me and said, I have a marriage problem. I said, well, what is it? I thought, I can't hear anything new. I've heard it all, every convolution. And they said, my wife has left me. And I said, well, you know, has she gone off with another man? No. You know, is she involved with another man? No. Well, you know, is it just that you're incompatible? And he said, no. I said, what's happened? He said, she's become a nun. And so at that point, I just thought, I'm going to retire from marriage counseling. This is too much. This is too much. So we're not going to get into the issues that might even be in your own mind. But what's happening here is Jesus will not allow what Moses tolerated. And he wants us to get back to the full meaning of marriage, covenant commitment, and unconditional love. And it's interesting that in some traditions, they say that the pastor or a priest cannot marry you. The pastor or the priest cannot marry you. He is only there as a witness. He does the ceremony, but he can't marry you. He is only there as a witness of God joining two people together. He stands in as a witness to that. And as Jesus says, what God has joined together, let no man separate. And of course, as we know, divorce had become very common in Israel. And now Jesus has to bring us back to the original issue. And again, it's the image of God in the woman that's being devalued. And this must be protected. So verse 32, he says, but I say unto you that everybody who divorces his wife except for the reason of porneia, marital unfaithfulness makes her commit adultery because for her own protection, she has to go out and remarry. Now, just one interesting thing, this little phrase, except for the reason of marital unfaithfulness, only occurs in Matthew. Only Matthew, not Mark, not Luke, not John. Okay, so Matthew adds this except for adultery. And you see why he adds it. In this case, the woman is an adulterer already, you see, and therefore divorce is acceptable. Divorce. Now, I say acceptable, not necessarily required, because the rabbis said that one had to divorce an unfaithful wife. They did not stone in the days of Jesus. They said you had to divorce them. Of course, Jesus did say to the woman caught in the act of adultery, "He who is without sin, pick up the first stone." But that wasn't normally done. Okay, but they had to divorce. But reconciliation is preferable and models God's unconditional forgiveness. You see that in the book of Hosea, if you know what it's about. So what's happening here is that Jesus says, okay, Moses said you could simply write out a certificate and send her away. But that is devaluing somebody in the image of God. And I will not have it, Jesus says. Perhaps in the case of adultery. But even there, reconciliation is maintaining unconditional love. And you know in Hosea, he is told to marry a prostitute. And when she leaves him, and this is Hosea, and goes back to prostitution, God says, go after her and get her back if you can, because that is covenant commitment and that is unconditional love. And when you are married, that is what you're modeling. You remember Ephesians 5, marriage is a model of what? Christ and the church, God and his people, unconditional love. And so, if possible, rebuild. And Jesus says, it may not sometimes be possible. And he accepts that. But no fault divorce, as they had in Israel. Jesus won't accept it.